you so much. I am indeed humbled by those extraordinary words. You spent too much time speaking about me, and I'm sure everyone in this room will agree with the accolades I would return to you. I would tell you this. You know your rabbi day in and day out, week in and week out. His reputation runs far beyond Queens, far beyond New York. He is the consummate Yashar, and I had the opportunity to work with Kashrut and education and rabbinic issues on the West Side with him, and he knows what is right and he knows what is Yashar. And you are indeed blessed to be shepherded by his staff, and may your cup continue to runneth over with his leadership for many more years. And I cast a glance at my dear friend Bezalel. I see him just about every few days. We often daven mincha together. We often daven mariv together. And he is indeed a treasure that I hope that everyone here understands that spreads also far beyond Queens. And we are the beneficiaries of his membership. He is a member of our congregation as well, as I said. Now we will have reason to have schar, not only for Pesha Yeta Bas Yehuda, but may all the learning that takes place from these books, these Sfarim Bezalel, serve as a zchus for you and your beautiful family. Thank you, Bezalel. This is the first shul that I gave shir, at the age of 21. Rabbi and Rebbetzin Kraus took a chance and allowed me to give an 8-week lecture series in the spring when I first moved into Kew Gardens Hills with my new bride. And I remember after the first shiur, just a few days later, we received a $100 check in the mail, and I came running to her and I said, "Elisa, they're paying me $12.50 per class. Can you believe this?" I didn't realize I was being paid. And it was amazing for us at the time. You know, this was about our half a year's salary. It was $100 per class. When another $100 came in the mail, I said, "Oh, they must have made a mistake. They can't be paying me $100 per shiur." But not only did they take that chance for that 8-week lecture series, but they continued to do so for semester after semester. And I said, "You know, I think I can do this. This is fun." And so we went into Rabbonus and went into education. So I think that I owe this shul a debt of gratitude for the... my father always wanted to be a lawyer or an engineer. And here, because of this shul, I became a rabbi. I was asked to speak about Megillat Esther. It's, of course, a festive day for the Jewish people. And it must continue to be so for the Pollock family. I'm especially connected to both Daphna and Ayala, who lived on the West Side. Ayala for some time, and Daphna and Yossi are dear, dear friends. I have a special camaraderie with them. Nebuch, I'm within the year of my own Avelus, as you may be able to see. People always come to the door now, and they ask to see my... When Elise answers the door, they ask to see if her father is home. The fact, though, is that when people say, "Are you keeping the beard?" it gives me a chance to talk about my mother. So harini kaparas mishkava for all of us who are within the year, and our parents should always be on our minds. But I have a special camaraderie with the family, but we always have simchas and many years to remember those dear departed. And when Yossi asked me to speak about Purim, I told him that Purim and Nebuch, I believe Chanukah is about the time where Yossi suffered a loss this past year. We often think of these days, of course, as festive times, but when it is punctuated by a specific loss, we'll always associate that day with that loss. But here we are, as you're doing, as it's appropriate to do, year after year, to turn the loss into something positive, into learning, as Bezalel did, and then into a gathering of Torah, as we're doing now. So I congratulate you on doing so, and now let's get to the program. The topic is the hidden message of Esther, and if I'm going to hide a message regarding Esther, if I'm going to hide a message regarding Esther, then the main message is going to be outside of the book of Esther. We will fail to appreciate and understand the full scope of what the book of Esther is about, what it means to us historically, unless we pay attention to these other verses outside of Esther. And I will start with a familiar line of the Gemara that says, Esther min haTorah minayin. Where is Esther hinted in the Torah? And the fact is, the question itself should give us pause, because the Gemara never says, Yecheskel min haTorah minayin, Yirmiyahu min haTorah minayin. Where is Amos hinted in the Torah? The Gemara doesn't ask where Nehemiah or Ezra is hinted in the Torah. Why is this fixation, by the way, not only Esther min haTorah minayin, it says Haman min haTorah minayin, Achashverosh min haTorah minayin, Mordechai min haTorah minayin. Everyone in Esther has to have a hint someplace in the Torah. So the reason for that penchant of the Gemara to try to find everything in the Purim story hinted in the Torah is because the canonicity of Esther was doubted well into Amoraic times, that the rabbis considered that Esther does not belong in the canon of the Bible. God's name does not appear. To this day, the Dead Sea Scrolls have not produced the book of Esther, but have produced all the other books of Tanakh in totality. It was not considered part of the Bible. So the Talmud, by the time they're asking this question, wanted to put forth the position that it is unequivocally part of the Bible, wanted to find hints to the book of Esther in the Bible. And the obvious hint that they see, some of you are nodding, you know the hint, Va'anochi haster astir panai mikem bayomahu. A day will come where I will hide my face from you. And the function of that hidden face, says the Gemara, is the fact that God's name does not appear in the story. The reason why God's name doesn't appear in the story, says Ibn Ezra, is because the story was put forth to the nation. It was disseminated by the Achashtar Panim B'nei HaRemachim, and Achashverosh's runners would never have done so if the hero of the story appeared to be Mordechai or God or some kind of religious message for the Jews. Therefore, the religious message had to be hidden from the average reader. It was what we might call Divrei Shalom Ve'emes, words that appear at the end of the story. Divrei Shalom for the Persians. Well, peaceful words for you. Let them think that Ahasuerus is the hero. But Divrei Emes, the Jews will know the truth. Their God is behind the story. That is the simple pshat of what the Gemara means when it says, Vanochi haster astir, I will hide my face from you that day. I would like to suggest, based on the title of this presentation, is that the what the Gemara means to say, Vanochi haster astir, means that the message of Esther is hidden. It's not just a story about a community that came to great danger and that was miraculously saved at the last minute. If you have an Encyclopedia Judaica at home, take P for Purim, and you will see under the heading Purim about 150 such stories in Jewish history where specific cities, states, countries actually take out a story and read about a particular salvation that happened to them in history, and they read the Megillah of that town. Ours happens to be called Megillat Esther. There are stories all over our history. So what is unique about this Purim story is something we might not get if we don't see these other verses. And here they are. Let's start. In chapter 4 of the book of Ezra, there is a description of the return of the Jews to Yerushalayim to rebuild the city. This did not sit well with the Persian anti-Semites, who felt that the Jews were a fifth column who cared more about Israel than the father nation. A canard that has been thrown upon us throughout our history. Those anti-Semites appealed to the Persian king. His name was Ahasuerus. Just open up Ezra chapter 4, verse 6. And you'll see that Ahasuerus put an end to the rebuilding plan that was promised by other Persian kings, Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes, and others. But a king named Ahasuerus, this is an important point. Ahasuerus is not limited to the book of Esther. He is mentioned in the book of Ezra. And he put an end to the building of the temple, the rebuilding of the temple that was that was initiated by a group called Tzorei Yehuda. It stands to reason that at the head of these Tzorei Yehuda, enemies of the Jews, would be a man that the Book of Esther calls Tzorer HaYehudim. Haman was probably the head of these people. The point is that if we fail to recognize the place of Israel and the place of Jerusalem in the forefront of what's happening in the Megillah, we will miss the main message of Esther. And the first chapter of this story, where Ahasuerus is considering that he will achieve what no other enemy of the Jews achieved, which is their destruction. Sancheriv didn't. Nebuchadnezzar didn't. Goliath didn't. Sisera didn't. Agob didn't. No other king who tried to destroy the Jews succeeded, because they did it the wrong way. They tried to do it by defeating the Jews. I have a better way to make the Jews forget about their holy land. When the Talmud asks, why did the Jews deserve the destructive forces of Haman's decree at this time? Remember the answer the Gemara gives? Not just that they attended the Seuda of Ahasuerus, al shenehenu mis'udas Ahasuerus. They enjoyed, they took part, and they wholeheartedly embraced this meal. What was this meal, says the Gemara? I must caution you, the dates I'm giving you now are not agreed upon by all historians. It's not important. The Gemara just makes this simple cheshbon. It says Nebuchadnezzar was king for 45 years. His son Belshazzar was king for 23 years. That's 68. In the beginning of Ahasuerus' third year, that is the end of the 70 years that Yirmiyahu promised from the first year of Nebuchadnezzar that the Jews would. I leave that blank because Yirmiyahu gave two separate cheshbonot of 70 years that caused confusion with everybody, not with just Ahasuerus, but with Daniel and Zechariah and Jewish prophets as well. There are two separate 70-year cheshbonot, one in chapter 25 of Yirmiyahu and chapter 29. And which one is which? What starts and where it ends? And what? You're right. The return is supposed to be confusing. We're not supposed to choose a date for our redemption. It's supposed to come each and every day. Therefore, let's get back to the point, is that Ahasuerus said, the 70 years are up. The Jews are not returning. See, I got them to become Persian before Jew. That's what Napoleon tried to do also. Remember, he wanted to reenact the Sanhedrin in the beginning of the 19th century. I'll make the Jews feel so at home in France, but on condition that they forget about Jerusalem. And that is the point of chapter 1 of Megillat Esther. If you look at the descriptions in chapter 1, pay careful attention this coming Motzei Shabbat when you're reading chapter 1 of how the party of Ahasuerus is described with all its splendor. Perek Aleph of Esther uses certain terminologies that only appear in Tanakh when it comes to descriptions of Jerusalem, the temple, or the sanctuary as is built in Sefer Shemot. Certain colors, certain words, you never find them again in the Tanakh, except with respect to, for instance, the only two cities in the entire Bible called Bira. Only one is Shushan HaBira and Yerushalayim HaBira. Shushan has replaced Yerushalayim. The Chatzar of Ahasuerus has replaced the Chatzar of the Beit HaMikdash. And the splendor of Ahasuerus has replaced the splendor of the Holy Temple. No wonder that our rabbis tell us that Ahasuerus did all this while wearing the garments of the Kohen Gadol. If you can't take that literally, as many of our commentaries don't, understand what it means in a deeper sense. Ahasuerus wants to replace our aspirations of redemption as is manifest in a return to Jerusalem with a redemption as is manifest with freedom of expression, freedom to enjoy the academy, the king's graces here in Persia. This was not a very good thing for us. At first glance, you would think it's wonderful. One of ours at the end of the story is the queen. One of ours at the end of the story is the prime minister. But all of that prevented so much promise made by Yirmiyahu, even Yeshayahu, Nehemiah, Ezra, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. that we would start a second temple that would even be more glorious than the first. But it didn't happen because the Jews got so comfortable in Persia. The hidden message of Esther is a powerful one for us today. The hidden message of Esther is that the author is writing with displeasure of how the Jews have become so comfortable in Persia. You can't state that clearly because for the same reason that we don't say Hallel on Purim. The Gemara wonders, why do we say Hallel on Chanukah but not on Purim? Now, the Gemara gives two answers, that the Megillah is the Hallel of Purim. Right? Which might imply that if Chas v'Shalom, someone is not able to hear the Megillah on Purim, they should say Hallel. But the Gemara gives a separate reason why we don't say Hallel on Purim. Because on Chanukah, at least when the story was over, we had our independence. And Purim, when the story was over, we were still Avdei HaShverosh. We didn't have independence. We were dependent on HaShverosh. We couldn't speak our minds at the end of the story. The Gemara says this with tongue in cheek when it tells us that the very last verse of Megillah that says Mordechai was Ritzui L'Rov Echov. What does that mean? Ritzui L'Rov Echov. Most of the people liked Mordechai at that time. There's never any Jewish leader that's liked by everybody. Someone who tries to be liked by everybody ends up, you know. But the point is that the Gemara, Daf Tzayin in Maseches Megillah, says, Pirshu Mimenu Mitzas Sanhedrin. The rabbis did not like the fact that Mordechai had his station where he was. I always ask at that point, would there be some people in this room who bedafka, excuse the politics now, it doesn't matter who you voted for, but did you possibly avoid voting for Gor Lieberman because you were afraid of having a Jew so high up in government? They can always blame us for things, right? Anyway, the Sanhedrin was not happy that Jews were so high up in Persian society. It made them feel so comfortable in Persia that such a paltry 42,360 returned to Jerusalem with Ezra and Nehemiah. That is the hidden message of Megillat Esther as we begin. Amazingly, the Megillah says that Ahasuerus had a party, remember, for 180 days. It says he took out six different types of splendor to show the people, and it describes five different types of people who were shown this great splendor. Five times six times 180, the Gemara says that he took out 5,400 objects of splendor to show off in this party. Four verses after the one I described just now, where it talks about Ahasuerus, and earlier in Sefer Ezra in chapter 1, it says that when the Jews came back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, they counted all the vessels of the temple that they had to bring back, including bowls and spoons and cups and whatever it is, and washing basins, 5,400. Amazing. And that's why, by the way, when you listen to the beginning of the Megillah, when they read about Ahasuerus taking out these kelim, the Baal Kori is going to read that verse. What's so sad about that verse? It just says they took out vessels and they drank from them. Why should that be Eichatrop? The answer is because the Talmud tells us that those were the vessels of the Beis Hamikdash. Ahasuerus is glorifying in his defeat of the Jews that I have them here comfortably enjoying my party while I'm wearing their holy garments, while I'm showing off their vessels, and they're enjoying it. They're not complaining. I've got them. They're mine. So this is a hidden message. There were some Jews who returned. There should have been 2 million Jews who returned. If 2 million Jews returned when the Balfour Declaration was written in 1917, before any white paper, before any other problems, Israel would be a very different country today. But alas, the problem of Parsha Shlach, of Meraglim, who look at the land and say, no, we can't do this, is a situation that repeats itself again and again and again. And that is a hidden message of Megillat Esther. I turn now, since we are here to remember dear, dear, wonderful woman, Peshe Yeta Bas Yehuda. I mentioned only the two daughters, Anar Ayala and Daphna. I mentioned also Shani and Meir and their families. will gesund sein and have many, many years to remember, and Bodo ben Chaim l'Chaim, Ephraim Pollock, you should have many years to remember. I would like to turn to another hidden message and direct it to her. It's an amazing verse in the book of Yirmiyahu, and it comes right on the heels of a description that we read about on Rosh Hashanah. It's in the Haftorah of Rosh Hashanah. It's the reason why this is the Haftorah of Rosh Hashanah, according to Rashi. It says, Habein Yakir Li Ephraim, you are my dear son, Ephraim. Im Yelet Sha'ashuim Ki Midei Dabri Bo Zachores Kirenu Od. I will never forget you, I will always remember you. Rashi says, this is because of this verse, this reference. It's Yom HaZikaron. So it says, Zachores Kirenu Od, I will always remember Ephraim. Al Kain Hamu Me'ailo, my innards. I've like butterflies over him. Hamu Me'ai means my stomach is churning over this, what I feel right now. Rachema Chavermenu Nehum Hashem, therefore I will always have pity on them. Hatzibi Loch Tziyunim, this I submit to you is what it really means to be a Zionist, as Rashi says on this verse. Set up Tziyunim. That's Tziyun from the Lashon Zion. Set up markers for yourself. Simulach tamurim. Shisi li beich lemesila derech halach. Shuvi besulas Yisrael. Shuvi elorayich eila. I know you are about to be marched up north to Bavel, but set markers along the way. A Zionist is someone who is mitsuyon about Israel and about Jerusalem. They set up markers. That's what it means. When you get a mitzuyon on the test, it means this is remarkable. This is outstanding. Make sure that Israel is always outstanding to you. Hatzibi lach tziyunim, to always return to this place. But alas, Yirmiyahu says, Ad mosai tischamokin. How long will it take? Tischamokin is a word that appears only twice in the Bible. Try to think. I'm about to tell you in about 5 minutes where the other place is. The shorish chamak, to disappear, appears only two places. Sfardim in the room will get it in a minute. I'll get it, yes. Chomak, how long will you disappear? My insides are churning over you, Israel. How long will you disappear, Habas HaShoveva? Here's the important verse. Ki bara Hashem chadasha. God will create something new in this world. Ki bara Hashem chadasha ba'aretz nikeva tisovev gover. It's very cryptic. The sign of our redemption will be the female shall pursue the male. What does this mean? Is this what we're experiencing? Nekeva tisovev gover. It's an extremely cryptic prophecy. If you want to know when the end will come, when the return to Zion will be upon us, it will be when the nekeva pursues the gever. That's the end of the prophecy. Rashi explains the nekeva that is pursuing the gever as symbolic. And I turn to the other place in Tanakh where the word chamak appears, Shir HaShirim. And amazingly, in close proximity, not only does the word chamak appear, but let's read a little bit of it. It says, Ani Sheina V'libi Er. I'm sleeping in my bed, but my heart is awake. Kol dodi dofek. The book that Rav Soloveitchik wrote about our redemption took these three words. Kol dodi dofek. The voice is knocking on the door. And he says, Pischi li achosi rayosi yonosi tamosi. Open up the door for me, my beloved. Shiroshinim latol kutsosai resise loyla. It's raining outside, and the rain is all over my hair. This is God talking to Israel. And he's talking about rain. That's why we recognize this from Anim Zemiros, these words. This must be symbolic of something. At least it means that God says, it's raining, let me in. The rain didn't keep me away. I could have made excuses about coming here, right? But I want you so badly, just open the door for me. And if, you know, Shir HaShirim is the saddest book in the Bible. Koheles is much, much more upbeat and a happy book than Shir HaShirim. If you really know what Shir HaShirim is, there's nothing sadder in humanity than two people who love each other who are not able to consummate their love. These two never meet. This man and woman are so sick in love with each other, who describe each other throughout the book in such monumental terms, but they never love each other at the same time. The man is God, the woman is Israel. He sends prophets to us throughout our history. He sent us an Amos, a Hosea, Micha, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Tzfanya, Chagai, Zechariah, and we are sleeping in bed, and he knocks at the door, and he says, open up. I already took off my clothes. I'm wearing my night clothes. I'm comfortable here in bed. Do me a favor. Come in the morning. Come in the morning. It's be light outside. We'll go for a stroll together. But at night, it's raining. The floor is muddy. I've already taken off my shoes and I have curlers in my hair. Come on. It says, look, she says, Dodi shalach yador min achor umeyai hamu alav. Remember, Al Kain Hamu Me'ai Lo and Yirmiyahu? He opened, I saw his hand. He put his hand through the window and he tried to open the door from the inside because it's locked from the outside. And I saw the hand of God. Oh my goodness, he's serious. He really does want to make his way in. This is serious. So she runs out of bed. Right? Kamti ani liftoach ledodi. Yeah, why didn't you answer when he knocked? So I got up and I saw his hand. There was all kinds of dippity-doo or all kinds of myrrh and all over in her hair, and it's running down her arms, and she's fiddling with the lock, and she can't get it open because she didn't expect to be answering the door so early at night. She thought, wait till the morning, I'll answer it in the morning. And by the time she gets to the door, we read the three saddest words in Tanakh. If you really feel, Rav Soloveitchik said he used to cry when he read these three words. V'dodi chomak ovar. He disappeared. So she runs out to the street to look for him. And of course, you know, she's dressed in her night clothes, running out in the street. She gets abused by the watchmen. And they say, what is a girl like you doing out in the street at night like this? And she starts describing the one who just knocked at the door. Let me tell you about my God. Let me tell you. And she goes describing him at great length. Right? And then at the end of the chapter, they say, what? You're describing your beloved in such terms? Can you finish my sentence? And you didn't open the door? What's going on here? And listen to what they say. Try to figure what is this historically. They said, come, let us help you find him. If that's your monotheistic ideal, that's the God you have, we can help you find him. This certainly represents the at least what the Rambam says, that we've taught them the vast majority of the world a monotheistic ideal and a moral ideal. Right? When we came along the scene, you worshipped a God for protection, for security, not for morality. How do we know that? Because the gods they were worshipping were not moral. They were profoundly immoral. They're always stealing from each other, and sometimes they even come down to earth and they steal a good-looking human being once in a while to consort with. They rob each other. They're not moral. We have a system of morality, and we taught that to the world. And they said at the end of Yeshua Shirim chapter 5, in the beginning of chapter 6, let us find this God with you. And they do. But at the end of this, the end of chapter 8, we're still told, keep your eyes open. I'm going to create something new in the land. Nekeva tesoviv gover. The Jewish people is the Nekeva. God is the Gever. I'm sorry, says Rashi. You're going to have to pursue God for a long, long time. You weren't there when he wanted you, when he sent you all those prophets. Okay, a time will come where you're going to have to search for him. That's Rashi. But I'd like to share with you another parish to this. It's the parish of the Malbim. He wrote this parish in the 1860s when he wrote his commentary to Tanakh. And he says, Rashi, you missed one word. Listen carefully. Yirmiyahu says, Ad mosaitis chamokin, how long will you disappear, O Israel? Habasa shoveva, rebellious daughter. Ki baro Hashem chadosho ba'oretz. It doesn't just say I'm creating something new. I'm creating something new in the land. Ki baro Hashem chadosho ba'oretz. Nekeva tisoviv gover. The oretz is a feminine word. When we entered the land after leaving Egypt, we conquered the land of Israel. True, the Yerushalmi says we gave the Canaanites some letters that said we'd like to live in peace with you if you keep seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, or you can leave or you can fight. We knew the choice they would take. They chose to fight. 31 Canaanite nations fought with us. Now we're coming back to Israel after a hiatus. We've been living in Bavel and in Persia. What is facing us when we come back to Israel? It's the same question that we asked in 1948. The Malbim wrote in the 1860s, I predict that when it comes time to go back to Israel, we will do so, we can only do so. Even if you're Neturei Karta or Satmar, you must admit, the Talmud says that we would go back to Israel. Forget about the Talmud. Yeshayahu says this. It's the Haftorah of Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, that the Gentiles of the world, not all of them, but a substantial number of them, will support the return of the Jews to the land of Israel. Not just support and say it's a good idea. Physically support them and help them. That's the only way that we could return. And the Malbim says that Nekevot Tesoved Gever, listen to the words, the land will pursue, in this case, according to the Malbim, the Gever is the people of Israel, will pursue the people. They will invite you back. The Persian kings will invite you back. They did, Darius, Cyrus, Artaxasta. But one Persian king felt, he was convinced by some anti-Semites, some Tzorei Yehuda, that this is not a good idea for us. Let's stop them. His name was Ahasuerus. The Purim story represents so much more than just a day that Haman chose to kill the Jews. There's a lot, surely there's a lot. Rav Soloveitchik has written a tremendous amount about the goral, the capricious nature of our stay in the exile. There's lots to be written about the story itself. But it's crucial that we understand what needs to be corrected from this story. Here we are. We're all in the galus. Whatever the reason is, we all have our reasons. But we should always understand, whether it's a plan, whether it's support, whatever it may be, that our eyes must always be on v'sechezeno einenu b'shuvecho l'tzion berachamim. And I know, of course, a community like this is very, very well known for this, but we cannot take too great a root outside. The Jew must always know this. For a practical reason, we never know by Yochum Melech Chodosh. I don't even mean to insinuate such a thing it can or would happen soon in the country where we live now. But that's been our collective experience throughout history. It's to always remember Hatzivi Loch Tziyunim. And there is so much in this book that needs to be corrected, that the authors hid between the lines. Haster, haster. I have to hide the main message of what we're supposed to take. Just one or two additional points to make, and then I will connect them to Pesha Yetzer. Is that, take note, if you can remember, when we read the first few chapters of Megillat Esther and Motzei Shabbos, how in the first four chapters, practically every verb means an action, is written in the passive tense. Kual or Nifa. You have to have the Megillah open in front of you, but it is Vatilokach, Nikra'o, Vayivukash, Vayivoda, Vayikosei, Vayimotsei. I'm only just mentioning a few. Uvehikovets, Behishoma, Yeosei, Yinosei. I'm just reading a few. What happens is the Jews had become stagnant. The Jews had left everything happen to them. Until, what's amazing, starting with chapter 4, where Mordechai convinces Esther to act, you don't see passive verbs anymore. Just take a note of this. You can read the Megillah, can read differently every time in another way. But take a look, first three chapters, every verb is in the passive voice, and then we move to active. Because there is a lot that needs to be corrected. And the center of that correction is in Jerusalem. And the main correction has to do with something the Talmud says, that we are bound to the observance of Torah not because of what happened at Mount Sinai, but because of what happened in the Purim story. Explain, what does that mean? Because at Mount Sinai, the Gemara says figuratively, we were coerced into receiving the Torah by a mountain that was held over our heads. Kofaleim har kegigis. Because the verse says, Vayisatzvu b'sachtis hahor, which is midrashically understood to mean They stood beneath the mountain, not at the foot of the mountain. They stood under the mountain. So Tosfos says, wait a second, a people that so readily said Naseh v'Nishma needed to be coerced into receiving the Torah? Tosfos does not give an answer to that question, but the Bechor Shor, one of the Balei Tosfos in his commentary to the Torah, does. He says, it's not a question. It's because the mountain was held over their heads figuratively that they said Naseh v'Nishma in the first place. What do we mean? The coercion, as it were, was the experience that the Israelites had just undergone. They had seen so many profound miracles that they were not able to make a reasonable choice. The Talmud tells us that God asked all the nations of the world, do you want this Torah? And the Ishmaelites said, well, what's in it? And he said, well, it says, don't steal. No, I can't have a Torah that says don't steal. So he went over to the Bnei Esau, he went to the Edomites. And they said, I have a Torah for you. Ophiyah Meha Paron, the Samir Vos Kodesh. Right? He went to the Bnei Esau. And they said, what's in it? And it says, Lo Tirtzach, don't kill. I can't have a Torah that says don't kill. And he went to the Moabites and said, well, we have a Torah for you. You want it? And they said, what's in it? And they said, well, it says, Lo Tinuf, don't come in. I can't have a Torah that says that. And he comes to offer it to Bnei Yisrael, and they said, how much is it? Right? But there's no medrash that says, what's in it? Right? They didn't ask what's in it. They just said, okay, Naseh v'Nishma, we'll take it. Of course, we have a slightly different history than Bnei Esav, Bnei Lot, and Bnei Yishmael. But still, we didn't ask what's in it. We should have said Nishma v'Naseh. Naseh v'Nishma is a lovely thing to say if you didn't make an ego 40 days later. Rashi points this out a few times in his commentary. That it was Gnevas Das. We lied to God by so readily saying, we'll just do. Tell me what's in it, that's it. We should have said Nishma v'Naseh. And that is corrected also in the Purim story. The Talmud tells us that we are bound to the Torah because it's written in the Purim story. Because in the Purim story we said, Kimu v'Kiblu. We accepted what we had done earlier without seeing those miracles, without that coercion. So I take all of these words with to wrap up of what a hidden message of Esther is all about. By nature, a hidden message is something that you have to uncover. You're not going to find it right away. You will not find it simply in the book of Esther by itself. We need to be steeped in some of the narratives of Ezra, Yirmiyahu, even how Yirmiyahu apparently is using Shir HaShirim, about a nation that fell asleep and became very comfortable under the Persian comforts, if you will, and they not only were comfortable with it, they enjoyed it, and history is what it is. I take this to refer to a beautiful family that I had a chance to observe, again, from the two younger daughters that I had seen, and I must say that we've seen the entire family on occasion with a simcha on the west side. This was a woman who was not passive, she was active. She was a woman who went from Naseh v'Nishma to Kimu v'Kiblu, and the children and grandchildren, this very impressive list that Rabbi Weiss read before, is testament to that. She was a Nekeva to Sovev Gover. She and her beloved Ephraim, as the prophecy that we just read from Yirmiyahu Lamed Aleph, were metakein a veritable kimu v'kiblu, and it was done in a way that indeed didn't rely on miracles, but appreciated the miraculous that comes upon us each and every day. And she was from the time that I knew her, it was mostly the time of her illness, but I never saw a complaint. Of course, I wasn't with her at all times, but she was always with her countenance was always bright. I remember a time where there was a question about the name Fradel in the family, and I know that she lived, Baruch Hashem, to see that name in the family, and that gave her such a nachas. And as I always say to congregants at such a time, We did not bury Pesha Yetta 3 years ago on Purim. We buried the body that her neshama inhabited. That neshama is here in this room. That neshama lives on in the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren that Bezrat Hashem will also carry the name Pesha Yetta. And sometimes we have to dig deep into what's hidden, to what's hidden, because that's what Esther is. She will always be associated with the name Esther. So the family will try to have to find something hidden. The Purim itself, it's an amazing day to have a Yortzeit. Mine is on Shavuos. It's our family minhag to fast on Yortzeit, so we get a pass on that. But so we associate, but it's still, may you always have this connection to Esther. May the hidden always have this ability to come out and burst before you, pitom, and be a source of it's hard to say simcha, but certainly nachas, and give you comfort for the entire family. It's an impressive group that's here, but from the names that should be in the family to remember such a grand and illustrious woman for many, many years. I appreciate this opportunity to be part of the family lore that I hope that whatever is taped from, of course, not only the shir, but all the introductions, should always be part of what the family hears and remembers from such a grand woman. And I'd like to thank you also, Bezalel, for, in her memory, for assuring that besides all that the family will do, but that there is also much Torah that is remembered in her name. May her name be a blessing upon this beautiful community. This is something extraordinary, that so many people would come out in such a way. And may her memory be a blessing upon her family, as well as upon her community, and upon Rabbi Weiss's leadership in this community. Thank you. Any questions? I see so many faces from the past here that I just mentioned one by one, from school, from the neighborhoods. So I thank you all for coming out. And Ezrat Hashem, we should all see each other for simplicity.